Join them in supporting public radio. Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. With offices in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infant-parent.com.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. On our show some weeks ago, may indeed have been some months ago, we had a conversation with an Egyptian journalist, a woman named Mona Eltahawy. And we talked about a number of things on that program, but we ended up spending a lot of time talking with her about her ideas and her thoughts and her experiences about women, generally speaking, about women and Islam. And made the argument for a kind of approach to her faith that says Islam began at a certain time and a certain place, but that the world has changed. And she argues for a kind of approach to religion and her religion that is willing to change with times. And among other things, for example, she talked about her interest in worshiping in the mixed groups, which a lot of Muslims would say, no, you shouldn't do that. And in response to that program, we heard from some folks here in the community who said, well, that may indeed be one viewpoint, but it's not the viewpoint of all Muslim women. And we would like to have the opportunity to also talk a little bit about how we see our place in Islam. And it's taken us a little time to get it into the schedule, but we did, in fact, want to do the program. And that is what we're going to do here this morning. We have here in the studio a guest with us and one joining us by telephone. And let me introduce them just briefly to you. Joining us by phone is Riham Nasser. She is Egyptian by her heritage, but did a lot of her growing up in the United States. In fact, most of her life she's lived in the United States. And she has an interesting background. She established the undergraduate program in conflict resolution at George Mason University. In fact, she was one of the first graduates with that major in the country. And while she was still an undergraduate, she became certified in interpersonal, family, community, and organizational mediation by the Supreme Court of Virginia. She became, in fact, the first Muslim mediator in the state, and later was given that same sort of distinction by the courts in D.C., District of Columbia, and also in Maryland. And after she graduated, she started a consulting organization interested in serving people who are underprivileged, who have limited English, and most importantly, perhaps, who wanted to apply the Islamic law in an effort to train and empower them to develop solutions to their own conflicts. She also has been an advocate and life coach for people who are surviving domestic violence. And she is joining us this morning by telephone. Here with us in the studio is Patsy Howell. She was born in the United States. In fact, she was born in Danville, and she was raised a Baptist. And she explains that throughout her life, she's been involved in the civil rights movement, in working against discrimination, in feminism, but felt that those movements didn't quite get her where she wanted to go. And when she became exposed to Islam, she figured that was a good direction, particularly because of the attitudes within Islam about racial equality. And so she became a Muslim in 1991, and she continues to be an activist in community with an Islamic approach to social reform. So we'll be talking here, and of course, people who are listening are welcome to call as well. Questions, comments are welcome from people who are listening, as always. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that people try to be brief and give us an opportunity to get in as many different people as possible. But 333-9455 is the number, and also toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, here in studio with us, Patsy Howell, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Glad to have you with us. Thank you. And here joining us on the telephone is Riham Nasser. Hello.
Good morning, David. Good morning, Patsy. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for that generous introduction.
Well, I hope that what I want to do is try at least to give people an idea, a little bit of an idea of who you are to start with. And then, of course, as we talk, maybe they'll get a better idea as well. And I don't know, maybe, Riham, is there anything that in particular that you would like to add just to start out?
As far as my introduction, you've done an excellent job. Thank you. No, at this time, nothing that I can think of, but I might weave it into what I discuss
okay.
later on.
Well, then I'll talk here with Patsy Howell, and I thought that you really wanted to say a little bit more about yourself, perhaps, as a way to start out. So again, people will get an idea, a little bit of an idea of who you are, and particularly how it is you came to be a Muslim.
Assalamu alaikum, Sister Ian. I'm so honored to be on the air with you and humbled. Okay. And that's why I needed to go in a little bit more of why Patsy Howell in Champaign, Illinois has, you know, can talk about this issue. Like David said, I was a Baptist in a rural community, a Southern Baptist. I seen the contradictions kind of early from that and seen a good look at Christianity up close and personal. And then when I was trying to find something else, it took me down many paths. My mother and my family were working class. My mother was extremely oppressed in a women's factory. So then communism, when I came across this ideology, looked pretty good. Then I also had black children and immersed myself in the black community, and the injustices and racism caused me to take on the fight against racism and search for justice there. And there's been many situations. For whatever reason, I took a big bite out of life. For whatever reason, a lot give me a broad base of to look at things. Working for a better healthcare system, I seen the healthcare system in this country and how people were hurting from that. I feel like I have a PhD, but it's not one that's going to give me wealth. It's not one that's, you know, I'm going to have a career. That's just a PhD in life, and hopefully, thanks to Allah, that it gave me, you know, some kind of wisdom. So that's where I'm coming from today, a day-to-day analysis and closeness, and I see that you are too. I also work at a women's shelter here in Champaign-Urbana, a domestic violence shelter. I'm a part-time receptionist, so I thought that was ironic. And so I think that, you know, I think that we've both seen day-to-day life, and maybe we can speak to women's oppression clearer than some of the people that are isolated and naive, some of the Muslim feminists that really haven't seen life.
Well, let me ask you both a general kind of question, because indeed there, I think in the minds of many people, there is this perception that women in societies that are predominantly Muslim are oppressed, that they don't have the rights that men do. And it's a kind of criticism that has come from Western feminists, but also from women who live in the Middle East and who call themselves feminists, and also some women like, for example, the guest that we had and when we talked with her, who is a Muslim herself. How do you even begin to address that? And obviously, this gets complicated, and we could talk about it for many, many hours, I'm sure. But how do you address that general perception? And I'll start with Reham Nasser first, and then, Patsy, you can get in on the question as well. How do you address that general perception we have to be careful because it is a generalization, because it's not true. It's different places you go, but there is this general perception that women in Muslim societies are treated as second-class citizens.
Thank you, David. And yes, I agree with you, Mr. Patsy, 100%. And life is the best of teachers. But building on the question that you just asked, David, the perception of Muslim women has varied over time. Pre-Islam and post-Islam are the two main ways that I'm going to explain it. Before Islam, women were viewed as lower or subservient to men. They couldn't interact in the everyday trading of businesses and or property. They were considered property, and they were in no way able to decide their fate regarding their lives, their marriage or divorce, and what would happen to their children. There were many levels of disrespect of women in general. Now, post-Islam, things have changed considerably. Not only are women perceived as rightful possessors of their own lives, and decision makers of their own lives. They can own property on their own without anyone else telling them what to do. They can engage in business and govern themselves in that way. They can inherit. Muslim women are the only women in any religion that actually receive their dowry. And that is something that has changed the perception of many people when they learn about it. Now, the perception of the West of Muslim women has changed over time, partially also because of the media and because of what has happened overseas and what happens here. And there are different levels of isms that affect the perception of Muslim women. Now, one of the articles that I ran across when I was doing some of the research that I needed to do for this interview was an article written by Yasmin Mujahid, and it's called Female-Led Prayers, A Step Backwards for Women. And it talks about the Western feminist perspective of women and the Muslim perspective of women. And if I could just take a second, I'll just elaborate a little bit more about what she said and even quote some of the points that she's mentioned that really touch the heart of the perception of women being Muslim or American or of any other background. Some of the points that Yasmin had mentioned was we have so forgotten the fact that God has honored women. And I'll constantly, just to take us a step back, I'll constantly refer to God as Allah, being that that is the name that God has chosen in Islam. And so if I ever use the word Allah, it also means God. So we've often forgotten the role of the honoring of women by Allah and giving them the values in relation to what Allah dictates versus what men dictate. And so in Western society, God is almost erased from the schematics of things. And so the only standard in which women are being perceived now is as the standard of women. Standard of men in relation to the standard of men. And so, for example, Western feminists will perceive just because a man can go out to work means that women can also go out to work. But we've forgotten that just because women can go out to work doesn't mean that they need to. One of the main roles that women...
Or want to,
exactly. That's very true. Thank you. And please feel free to step in at any time. One of our God-given rights as women that makes us special from men, no offense, David, or any other man that's listening, is that we can bear children. And that role is a fundamental component of our role in life and the succession of society. And if we realize what that means, we might not necessarily want to be out there providing for our families when a man can definitely do that if he chooses to, and a woman can do that if she chooses to. But the priorities, and that's what governs the underlying issue here, the priorities are to the family first. So if both parents go out and work, who's taking care of the children? The babysitter? The school? Friends? Family? Themselves? The TV? Also known as the electronic babysitter? That does not instill in our children, in the future of our generation, the morals, the values, the ethics of what governs a Muslim family, or an American family, or any other family across the world. So one of the other things that Yasmin has mentioned that was really profound for me was she said, let me think back just a second. She said, 50 years ago, we saw men, and I'm quoting her, we saw men leaving the home to work in factories. We are mothers, and yet we saw men doing it, so we wanted to do it too. Somehow we considered it's women's liberation to abandon the raising of another human being in order to work on a machine. That's just building on the previous point. Now, the next point that I wanted to bring up was, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, only 31% of mothers with babies and 18% of mothers with two or more children are working full-time at this time. That's a big shift in the paradigm between the 1950s and 2000 now, where women started to go into the workforce and the children were not being raised by the family. Now, as of those working women, the survey conducted by Parent Magazine in 2000 found that 93% of these women say that they would rather be home and their kids, with their kids, but are compelled to work due to financial obligations. Now, these obligations, we can question that as an underlying issue. What are these obligations? Are they imposed on women by men and or society, or are they imposed by women by other women, expecting them to be liberated, quote-unquote, in that way? Or are they obligations required for us to coexist in this life? Now, if it is the latter, meaning I need to provide for my family, I'm a single mother, then by all means do so. But if you don't have to necessarily provide for your family, then who will be taking care of the children? So the children are number one in Islam, because they will bring forth the future leaders of the community. Now, the second major point that I need to build on is the role of the wife and the role of the homemaker and the role of the woman with a perfect career. Juggling all three of these is a task in itself. Working full-time is exhausting, and I can attest to that. Now, being a daughter...
Me too.
I'm sure any woman can attest to that. Being a daughter, a wife, a mother, a sister, any role that any woman plays, in addition to that role, is extra. And so if we have 24 hours in a day and we're only given a certain amount of time to work and a certain amount of time to stay at home with family and a certain amount of time allotted for ourselves...
I'm tired now.
Exactly.
I'm tired just thinking about it.
Exactly. Where does God fall into this? Where does Allah fall into this? Because we need, as Muslims, to give Allah priority in our life. Where does our own self fall into that? Because we, as Muslims, need to balance the role of everything else in our life, in this world, and our responsibility to ourselves. Because if we are not whole and we are not healthy, we can't provide. And then where does our spouse or our family fall into that? When the majority of the time when you're coming home, you're doing the dishes, you're cleaning, you're washing, you're doing homework, where's the quality time? The society has changed drastically, very dramatically, over the past 20 or 30 years.
It also, I think, keeps us from having any kind of leadership positions in our community, among our sisters, any kind of studies. And we know that we have equal responsibilities in the eyes of Allah, just like Muslim men. Hello?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Exactly. No,
and so, you know, in fact, all this oppresses us more and keeps us from doing many of the important things that we really, in fact, receive our dignity and self-respect from, and our help our children and our spouses and our families to look up to us.
Exactly.
Because we're just workhorses. We're just barely taking care of the basic responsibilities. In fact, they've got us going back and just trying to find a meal every day.
Pretty much. I can give you an example of my personal life, and please, Sister Patsy, if you want to continue right after that, I can make it really quick. As a professional, I'm well-respected in my field. I work with the judges, I work with the attorneys and the court personnel, I work with the clients and everyone else in the legal system. Not having to be an attorney helps in many ways. Having to be an attorney, for example, if I were to choose to be one, that would take me into a different dimension in my life. But currently, as a conflict resolution consultant and trainer and mediator, my main role is to do what I can to preserve the dignity of my Islamicity at work. And so when I go to work, for example, the first thing that I heard from a judge a while back was, "You're not dressed in the proper attire." Now, does that come from a lack of information about Islam? Does that come from the media? Does that come from Western qualifications of attire versus being accepting of the differing attires just because someone is in a particular atmosphere? Of course, in every atmosphere there is a dress code. And the difference between my dress code and the average court personnel dress code was I was not wearing a suit. I was wearing a long dress, also known as a abaya. Or a jilbab, and that just covers from my neck down, and a scarf. and it was the scarf that the judge was referring to. Not to make a discriminatory remark, but a point to just clarify that this is not the standard. And after a long discussion with the judge and clarifying to the judge what my religious obligations were, that was then clarified, and it was hello?
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Yes. It was clearly understood that that was something that I could bring to the table. Now, having received the respect in my professional life, how does that hinder my personal life? Because it is a full-time job. It does hinder. And anyone that is able to balance both is a superwoman for me, and my hat is off to her, you know. But to be able to balance it and give the due right for both is extremely, extremely difficult. Please go ahead, Pat and Sister Pat.
Well, I one of the things I wanted to bring up is the manipulation of women and how feminism has led into that. Many of us know the story of Rosie the Riveter, and if you don't know the story, and you may have seen the posters, there's a woman, big eyes and big muscles, and it was Rosie the Riveter, and this was celebrated through, I think, the Second World War, and these posters were up, and women, they needed women in the workplace. They needed women to fill in for soldiers that had left. They needed productions in their military installation, and so they encouraged, and it became the thing for women to be out in the workforce, and all advertisement went to that, and now you'll find that is a poster that exists. And yet when the soldiers came home, they needed women out of the workforce. And so it's documented. And if you study the cultural advertisements, you'll see that then she was encouraged to stay home and dress very nice, and all the commercials and all the advertising changed in that direction. It was manipulation of the media. And so, and feminists know this very well, because most feminists come from a movement I came from, and that movement, Rosie the Riveter was upheld. Feminism, even the progressive women in progressive movements, prior to even in the late 80s, we had decided that feminism as an ideology was not working to deal with any of the oppression of women, whether it be health care, whether it be the sustaining of the family, whether it be abuse, sexual and domestic abuse, all the things that women face. Yes, women are oppressed. No one can sit and say the women of the world aren't oppressed. Allah, as our creator, understood that, and that's a whole nother discussion. But women are oppressed. But then what do we do? And we found that, in fact, in the leadership of the feminist movement, they had taken real oppression, working class women, and used them as cotton fodder, and used them in the movement to get better jobs for upper middle class women that wanted a piece of the pie, and the crumbs weren't enough. So what they did was they led demonstrations, and they secured their jobs in the upper echelons of companies. And then what the rank and file of the feminist movement got to be daycare workers in daycare for a very little amount of money, sometimes having to work two jobs, sometimes having to have their own children in those daycares and pay for that daycare. So we can go on and on about the crimes of the feminist movement and working women and poor women. Okay, but the feminist movement has aided that. And as far as Islam, I mean, one of the things that I'm doing right now, my daughter and I have a show, I guess I can mention it, Daughters of Eve, on Saturday mornings, 11 o'clock, on the low frequency 104.5 FM. And we've been doing a lot of research. And one of the shows we did was in the Daughters of Eve was, in fact, Eve. And two of the things that have been distorted by not only feminists, but everyone in the world is that, and doesn't happen in Islam, is that Eve, in fact, brought down the whole of mankind, that she herself it seduced, induced Adam to take a bite of the apple. And Islam, that's not the story of Eve. They were both responsible. They were both, and consistently in Islam, both are responsible for their deeds. Both have responsibility for their action. Now, when you start, and never once in the feminist movement did we talk about that. It's like, did we not talk about it because we were atheists? Maybe we were atheists, but the country we lived in and a lot of the women out there are under this impression that Eve brought down. The other thing was Miriam. When Mary had Jesus, it's like the first time I was at a group discussion with Muslim women that had never heard like our, being, you know, the American tale of Jesus. It's like we kept saying, where was Joseph? They kept saying, Joseph who? Well, where was the inn? What, the Holiday Inn? Because the beautiful story of Miriam and Islam, Joseph wasn't there, okay? They did not need that nucleus family. You know, they told the story as it was. Miriam gave birth to, you know, and was had chastity. So these are two major, okay, major stories that women lead their life, either as innuendos or as a background. This in Islam is expelled. So, you know, I just wanted to mention that. So, yeah, I think that, you know, working women, you know, I was under feminism. I had children. I had to work. I didn't plan my life. I had no protector. And yes, it's been a hard life. Okay, I've learned a lot from that. The other thing is in Islam that we have many, when you talk about work, the Prophet's wife, first wife Khadija, was a traitor, was his boss, asked him to marry her, and was financially responsible for him. So what stronger identity could you see? We have many, many stories like that. Obviously, we don't have time to go into all the strengths on women of Islam here, because one of the very important things that I wanted to talk about is now, in this time, the attacks on Islam and women. And a lot of times, the attacks on Islam was directed first at women. When we look at Afghanistan, before we heard about 9/11, the Taliban, whatever, you know, even as Muslims, it wasn't really, you know, we were just hearing a little bit about that. They were being attacked. In 1999, I have an article here in Glamour magazine. Hello, Glamour. You've never said too much of any importance except how to put on makeup. But this article has asked in a very passionate, a very passionate story about the oppression of women in Afghanistan, led by Jay Leno's wife. We all remember her fight against burqas, and she was the head of the Feminist Majority Foundation and campaign to stop gender apartheid. Although I don't know about real apartheid, in South Africa, I never heard her speak out against that. And, you know, and it says, this was backed by the Clinton administration. Obviously, it was attack on Afghanistan through the covering of their women. Mm-hmm. Now, this is also ironic because I assume she lives in New York, and I lived in New York for a long time. Now, you can live in the Midwest and not see real oppression of women and peoples. You can go to your subdivision. You can get in your car. You can go to your job and really very seldom have to experience the day-to-day oppression of women in this particular town. However, in New York, it's up in your face, okay?
Same when in you California step, where she lives.
Mm-hmm. Pardon me?
Same in California where she lives.
Oh, California. She lives in California. Right. I don't know why I assume she lived in New York. Yeah, California. On either coast, there is no way that it's not up in your face. And so why Afghanistan? Why is your heart felt and your passion for oppression of women over some burqas in Afghanistan? that's a question I've had for a very long time when there's healthcare issues here. It talks about infant mortality in this country when we were in this area when we were dealing with healthcare issues for the poor. There was one of the largest areas of infant mortality was in fact in this area. So I thought that was ironic. The other thing is there was a Fourth World Conference on women in China where it says this was in 95, well, many years before, as we can see, before some of the things have come to light. And it says in one of the press releases, many enemies of Islam are very disturbed to see Muslim women observing Islamic dress and face veil. They sense that these few women have caused their efforts to strive against Islam to go to waste. Some have commented that it seems that these veiled women are increasing in number at the conference, but it is only that Allah has made these few sisters seem many in their eyes. And I've also personally felt that in this community I've been involved. In fact, right now I work in the Muslim Women's Outreach Organization. And if you want to know more about that, it's MuslimPreacher.com. And some of the women are veiled in this organization. And prior to that, I've worked with a lot of veiled women in efforts in this community. And I found them to be the most active, the most prepared, the most organized.
It's a common issue that affects many Muslim women across the world. I know in France, everybody's heard about the students in the French schools that were expelled or suspended because they wore their scarf in the school. In Tunis or in Tunisia and Algeria, same issues. Turkey, someone part of their parliament that was wearing the first Muslim woman that wore hijab or scarf in parliament was relieved of her post. It's a struggle that a lot of us face. Because we are the visual perception of Islam. Now, men also wear hijab. They also wear a covering, and that is their beard. It's just a different perception of things. But men get to blend in easier because the beard sometimes has been popular by some men, and it's popular, it's not so popular by others. But we are the face of Islam.
Right. And also there's been a lot of money and scholarships and various things given on campuses and trips and many things, I think, to promote the Muslim feminists opposed to, no one's offering that for the voice of non-Muslim feminists. And thank you, David.
I want to jump in here just because we've already used more than half of our time.
Oh, okay.
And I do want to reintroduce our two guests here. Joining us by telephone is Riham Nasser. She works as a family mediator, a divorce conflict mediator. She's also certified in Islamic family law. She lives on the East Coast. And here with me in the studio is Patsy Howell. She is a community activist with an Islamic approach to social reform, and we're doing the show here to give the opportunity for our guests here to talk about their perspective on women in Islam. And it was intended as a kind of reaction to a response to a program we did some weeks ago with another woman who is also a Muslim, an Egyptian journalist named Mona El-Tahawi. One thing I wanted to ask you about, Riham,
sure.
You just mentioned this in passing, and it was something that turned out to be a big topic of conversation when we did this other program, and that was female-led prayer. The guest made this argument that she would like to be able to pray and thinks it would be appropriate to pray in a mixed group with men and women together, with women leading the prayer. And some callers called in and said they felt that that was not correct. And I'm interested in the two of you talking about that. And if that is a particularly big issue for you, or why you would think that that would be a not an appropriate thing to do. Obviously, to the other guest that we talked to, she said that it sounded like it would be a very important thing to her and something that she thought would be a good thing, something that certainly not, I know, not all Muslims would agree with. What do you think about that?
Well, I have two major points about that. I'm glad that you brought it up. I'm sure... I'm sure she's well qualified in her own right, and I'm sure Mona has a lot to say. But to bring it back to the basics, so that we take opinions out of it, the basics for Muslims is usually the Quran as the governing force or the ruling laws of Islam, and then the teachings of the Prophet, also known as the Sunnah, are the application of the rulings of Islam. And so that would be our basics that we go back to. And one of the points that she brought up was, like you said, the leading of the prayers and the progressiveness of, or the modernization of Islam in order to incorporate these viewpoints. And one of the points that I want to stress is we sometimes confuse the fact that Islam is unclear or backwards or antique, when in fact Islam has absolutely no room for change or innovation. And so progression and advancement in education or sciences are greatly welcomed. Just like the first verses that came down from the Quran, they came down by Angel Gabriel to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, stressed the importance of reading and seeking knowledge. Now, with that in mind, we can't confuse the fact that we should not compromise our belief and our religion in an attempt to make Islam fit a current surrounding that we live in, or a current environment or situation. So with that in mind, in summary, with that first point, it's not the religion that needs to change, it's the people adhering to the timeless and universal message of the religion. And so, for example, with leading the prayers, the role of Muslim women in Islam is very clear. And it's very obvious that it's been defined where the men are in prayer and where the women are. And for those of you that are not aware, the men pray in the front, and prayer is usually led by a man, and the women pray behind. And there are differences between culture and religion. There are some cultures that perceive that there is flexibility in Islam. There are some cultures that perceive that there is no flexibility in Islam. But we don't go by culture, we go by religion. And so therefore, Allah clearly clarifies the best position for each gender in Islam. And there's no question that Allah has clearly established that there's a place for a woman and there's a place for a man. Now, regarding the general affairs of who prays, where, and how business is conducted, it is based on what is favorable in the eyes of Allah and not what is favorable for women as they perceive it, or for men as they perceive it. So it's hard to explain it without saying, if someone believes in the Quran and the Sunnah, meaning the governing forces of Islam, then they will not question the underlying concepts behind it. Now, I'm not saying don't question things in Islam. I'm saying it's a reflective religion, and it's built on common sense. But at the same time, there are things that we have to take, understanding that there is no question about, for example, where the women pray. So if a woman were to lead prayer, the first person that I would think of personally that would be the first person to lead a prayer would have been the wife of the Prophet, peace be upon him, Aisha. And if she were the person that would have led the prayer, she would have done it. But during that time, the Prophet did not tell her to go lead the prayers. She did not step up and lead the prayer. And she would have been the first and probably one of the only women to be validated to do so. Now, the second person would have been the daughter of the Prophet, who was also close and dear to his heart and also very knowledgeable. Aisha was a scholar in Islam. She was the first Muslim scholar. Fatima, Al-Azhar University, one of the main Islamic universities, was named after her, Fatima al-Zahra. So, and that's the derivation of her name being the name of the university. As far as leading the prayers, they would have been the first to lead the prayers. Now, if they didn't question it and they upheld the guidelines of the religion, of the Quran and of the Sunnah, the rulings and the teachings of the Prophet ﷺ, then why is it that we question it now?
Right, they were very strong women, the stories of them.
It just proves the point that it is a universal religion, it is timeless, and that we can't change it to fit our time or govern what we want and what we don't want.
Also, and you talked about logic. I mean, for those out there that don't know how we pray, the logic of our Creator knows that women, just as men, do sujood. And sujood is to put your head on the ground in humbleness to Allah. Obviously, you can imagine if you put your head on the ground, what position your body's in.
Thank you for covering that topic and not letting me do it.
I know. Well, I'm old, okay? And so obviously your bottom's up in the air, okay? And so this is, obviously, there's no way, even when guests come to the masjid that don't know, and men come and they set their chairs in the back of the masjid, I ask them, you know, can you please go over to the side? This is not something that we should have to worry about when we're praying, and we're spiritual and we're praying to, our Creator. And one scholar, you know, I forget his name, but, you know, I seen him once, and he one of his fortes was to talk to Christians and explain Islam, and he was very old, and he said he was from South Africa, and he just died, so you probably... So he was saying in the video, he said, yeah, you can understand. It's like you pray next to your sister. It's like cushy-cushy. It's like what a lot of women and men or enemies or whatever changes in Islam, it's a very like egotistic, kind, self-centered kind of thing. I want to do this. I want to do that. I think we should do this. I think it should be changed because I want to do this, or I'm under feminism, so I think it's right. But the bottom line is our Creator give us the guidelines. And one of the protections in Islam is the protection of the family. And any of us that has grown old enough that's ever been betrayed by their spouse, hurt by their children, betrayed by their sisters or brothers, all the things that family constitute know that to have that family unit intact is very important. And yes, after a while, with enough mixing and enough praying and cushy-cushy, you're going to have... a tremendous amount of problem that's eventually going to destroy families. And we can't go into, you know, the role of the family in Islam and all the protections, but obviously we also protect our young daughters.
Yeah. We are coming to the point here where you have about 5, 6, 7 minutes. And I do have a caller who's been very patient, and I want to try to at least give that person an opportunity to get in here in the conversation. On our line 1 in Champaign County. Hello.
Hi. I guess I should have called in earlier because this is a complicated issue, but I hear all this decrying of feminists. Are there any projects of feminism? There surely are class problems inside of feminism, but I think the sketching of it that you're giving it isn't fair. And I think there was also manipulation of the image of Islam and leading up to the Afghanistan attack and the whole GWOT, Global War on Terrorism, that's going on. But on the other hand, I think there are some things that are subject to criticism inside of any religion. I'm very critical of a fundamentalist, dominionist Christianity, which sees itself as very much opposed to Islam. So I think we're probably could be allies on that score. But the idea of the pre-Islamic ritual of genital mutilation, which has nothing to do with Islam, but is performed in some Islamic cultures, Egypt being one of them, still to this day, and it's done by women on women, and the idea is that it's I think that there's a critique of this culture in that I think that a lot of the psychiatric drugs are actually sort of a pharmacological neutering. They suppress sexual drive, et cetera. So there's actually a sort of a parallel, and that's a rather complicated and undiscussed issue, and I don't know whether you want to go into that, but aren't there some criticisms of religion that come from different quarters, including feminism, that you could share with?
Well, Riham, you want to, you respond to that?
I'll take half that question.
Okay, I'll come in.
If you want to do the other half. The point that I wanted to make was related to the genital mutilation. And thank you, caller, for asking that question and for asking your question in general. There is a dichotomy that maybe I didn't clarify very well in my statement earlier, but there is a dichotomy between culture and religion, that there's a difference between culture and the role of religion and the role of culture in our life and which one governs which. And so many times Muslims and non-Muslims alike make the fault that Islam is the cultural practice. And be it in Egypt or anywhere else in Africa or in Europe or in Asia or anywhere else in the world that practices genital mutilation, that is not a religious practice. And I'd like to clarify that point. Be it a cultural practice, as it is perceived in many of these countries, it has died down considerably due to the education of the people, education of the government, and the movements that have taken place to try to eliminate this whole mutilation of genitalia of women in general. So with that point said, I need to stress that there is a big distinction between what Islam governs and how people practice it. Don't learn Islam from people, learn Islam from the religion itself, and from the book and from the teachings of the Prophet. Unfortunately, just like in every religion, just like you mentioned regarding the caller and his question, in every religion there are the practicing, there are the not practicing, and there are those that just call themselves by name part of that religion. So that is the message that I would like to send as far as genital mutilation. Go ahead, Patsy, if you had any other comments?
I'll take the point on feminism.
Okay.
And when you said that, there's things that we agree on, I'm sure, from the way that you were talking, there's many things we agree on. I still have a lot of friends, old comrades that that I feel are progressive, and there's a lot of places that Muslims and sometimes leftists join together against war, against many things. I was speaking to the ideology of feminism. I never once will say that there's not women's oppression all over the world, that in fact it's gotten worse. We don't have a lot of time, but you know if you're a progressive man that's worked with in the movement, that there's many things that can be said about women's oppression around the world. Only Allah knows. I hope I have fought for the rights of women and against the oppression of women most of my adult life, and continue to do that. However, I think that feminism is not the answer, the ideology of feminism, and I think Muslim women that adapt that ideology and try to somehow put that ideology together with Islam are enemies. Okay, to Islam and to women, and especially oppressed women all over the world. I can only be who I am, and I'm a little more aggressive. I come from a real political background, so I think that there's problems. Are there problems in there's not problems in the religion. Islam was given to us perfect. Is there problems in the way that that religion's perceived? Believe me. Ask anyone in my community. I am a fighter. I'm not only a fighter outside the mosque, I'm a fighter inside the mosque. So yes, but the bottom line is that after 16 years in Islam and after everything that I've seen, I truly believe that Islam itself is perfect and given. It took me a long time. I was an atheist prior to Islam, so it took me a long time to even believe in God. But once I did, I believe that God did create us and created a religion that helps us. Thank you.
If I can just add with one quick minute.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you. I'd like to refer you, Mr. Caller, to an article that I read.
<Mr. Caller>.
It's called Burqa, B-U-R-K-A, versus Bikini. And it's written by Dr. Henry McCow. That's M-A-K-O-W. And it's about the debauchery of American womanhood. And it talks about feminism, and unfortunately we didn't have enough time to bring this article in, but it talks about the distinction between feminism and Islamism, if that's even a word, and his perception of things as a American man. And so that's just one of the articles that you can refer to and get a better understanding of the role of feminism in the U.S. specifically, and how different religions are perceived under the guides of feminism.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to say we've used our time, and we're simply going to have to stop at this point. With much more, it can be said. Perhaps on some other days we can talk some more. But for the moment, we have to say thanks to our guest joining us by telephone, Riham Nasser. She works as a family separation divorce mediator. She's certified in that, as well as a certified commercial and federal workplace mediator. She is also a consultant in the conflict resolution field. She's a graduate of George Mason University. She's out on the East Coast. Here in the studio with us is Patsy Howell. She was not born a Muslim, but she became a Muslim in 1991. Been, as she explained, very much involved in the civil rights movement and continues to be a community activist with an Islamic approach to social reform. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for having us very much.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from World Gourmet Foods, 120 Krispy Kreme Drive, just off Veterans Parkway in Washington and Bloomington, serving Bloomington Normal and surrounding cities with gourmet cheeses, chocolates, olives, and foods from around the world. Grand opening taste testing day will be held on Saturday, April 1st. World Gourmet Foods, 309-663-2222. Also, the broadcast made possible with support from Prairie Land Community Supported Agriculture, proud to support informational programming on WILL. Prairie Land CSA links consumers wanting local pesticide-free produce directly with the farmers who grow it on the web at prairielandcsa.org. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, some conversation about the brain and how it works. Inside your head, your brain. Inside your brain, 100 billion neurons. How do they provide us with thoughts, with the appreciation of art, or with the love that we feel for one another? We'll look into some of the mysteries of the brain coming up on the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn, the host for the show, will be talking with Shannon Moffat. She's a medical student at Stanford and author of a recently published book entitled The 3-Pound Enigma, The Human Brain and the Quest to Unlock Its Mysteries. That's coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour of the show today. The show gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news, weather, sports feature. Celeste Quinn is the host. Coming up in the next part of this program, we'll be shifting our focus and we'll be talking about the health of the oceans. And our guest for the program will be Julia Witte. She is a documentary filmmaker who specializes in doing underwater films. She's authored a featured article on the ocean in the current issue of Mother Jones magazine and will be talking with us by phone in the next hour. Right now, we're going to break for news and update on the market, so stay tuned.
Agricultural information on AM 580.